Chapter 30. Laughter ringing, or saw the bright blue eyes. When I knew them both were young, I become young as I think of him. And this morning he was alive again in this room, ready to laugh, to fight, to weep. As I write, do you know, it is the gray of evening, the house is quiet, everybody is out, the room is getting a little dark, and I look rather wistfully up from the paper with perhaps ever so little fancy that he may come in. No? No movement. No gray shade, growing more palpable, out of which at last look the well-known eyes. No, the printer came and took him away with the last page of the proofs. And with the printer's boy did the whole cortege of ghosts flit away, invisible? Ha! Stay! What is this? Angels and ministers of grace. The door opens, and a dark form enters, bearing a black suit of clothes. It is John. He says it is time to dress for dinner. ... Every man who has had his German tutor, and has been coached through the famous Gustav Key, if thou wert my instructor, good old Weissenborn, and these eyes beheld the great master himself in dear little Weimertown, has read those charming verses which are prefixed to the drama, in which the poet reverts to the time when his work was first composed, and recalls the friends now departed, who once listened to his song. The dear shadows rise up around him, he says. He lives in the past again. It is today which appears vague and visionary. We humbler writers cannot create Fausts, or raise up monumental works that shall endure for all ages. But our books are diaries, in which our own feelings must of necessity be set down. As we look to the page written last month, or 10 years ago, we remember the day and its events. The child ill, mayhap, in the adjoining room, and the doubts and fears which racked the brain as it still pursued its work. The dear old friend who read the commencement of the tale, and whose gentle hand shall be laid in ours no more. I own for my part that, in reading pages which this hand penned formerly, I often lose sight of the text under my eyes. It is not the words I see, but that past day, that bygone page of life's history, that tragedy, comedy it may be, which our little home company was enacting, that merrymaking which we shared, that funeral which we followed, that bitter, bitter grief which we buried. And, such being the state of my mind, I pray gentle readers to deal kindly with their humble servants' manifold shortcomings, blunders, and slips of memory. As sure as I read a page of my own composition, I find a fault or two, half a dozen. Jones is called Brown. Brown, who is dead, is brought to life. Aghast, and months after the number was printed, I saw that I had called Philip Furman, Clive Newcome. Now Clive Newcome is the hero of another story by the reader's most obedient writer. The two men are as different, in my mind's eye, as Lord Palmerston and Mr. Disraeli, let us say. But there is that blunder at page 990, line 76, volume 84 of the Cornhill Magazine, and it is past mending, and I wish in my life I had made no worse blunders or errors than that which is hereby acknowledged. Another finis written. Another milestone passed on this journey from birth to the next world. Sure it is a subject for solemn cogitation. Shall we continue this storytelling business, and be voluble to the end of our age? Will it not be presently time, O prattler, to hold your tongue, and let younger people speak? I have a friend, a painter, who, like other persons who shall be nameless, is growing old. He has never painted with such laborious finish as his works now show. This master is still the most humble and diligent of scholars. Of art, his mistress, he is always an eager, reverent pupil. In his calling, in yours, in mine, industry and humility will help and comfort us. A word with you. In a pretty large experience I have not found the men who write books superior in wit or learning to those who don't write at all. In regard of mere information, non-writers must often be superior to writers. You don't expect a lawyer in full practice to be conversant with all kinds of literature. He is too busy with his law, and so a writer is commonly too busy with his own books to be able to bestow attention on the works of other people. After a day's work in which I have been depicting, let us say, the agonies of Louis on parting with the captain, or the atrocious behavior of the wicked Marquis to Lady Emily, I march to the club, proposing to improve my mind, and keep myself usted up, as the Americans phrase it, with the literature of the day. And what happens? Given a walk after luncheon, a pleasing book, and a most comfortable armchair by the fire, and you know the rest. A doze ensues. Pleasing book drops suddenly, is picked up once with an air of some confusion, is laid presently softly in lap. Head falls on comfortable armchair cushion. Eyes close. Soft nasal music is heard. Am I telling club secrets? Of afternoons, after lunch, I say, scores of sensible fogies have a doze. Perhaps I have fallen asleep over that very book to which Finis has just been written. And if the writer sleeps, what happens to the readers? Says Jones, coming down upon me with his lightning wit. What? You did sleep over it? And a very good thing too. These eyes have more than once seen a friend dozing over pages which this hand has written. There is a vignette somewhere in one of my books of a friend, so caught napping with Dennis, or the Newcombs, in his lap, and if a writer can give you a sweet soothing, harmless sleep, has he not done you a kindness? So is the author who excites and interests you worthy of your thanks and benedictions. I am troubled with fever and ague that seizes me at odd intervals, and prostrates me for a day. There is cold fit, for which, I am thankful to say, hot brandy and water is prescribed, and this induces hot fit, and so on. In one or two of these fits I have read novels with the most fearful contentment of mind. Once, on the Mississippi, it was my dearly beloved A Cop Faithful. Once at Frankfurt O.M., the delightful Inked and Zappers of Monsieur Dumas. Once at Tunbridge Wells, the thrilling Omen in White. And these books gave me amusement from morning till sunset. I remember those agefits with a great deal of pleasure and gratitude. Think of a whole day in bed, and a good novel for a companion. No cares. No remorse about idleness. No visitors. And the woman in white are the Chevalier d'Artagnan who tell me stories from dawn to night. Please, ma'am, my master's compliments, and can he have the third volume? This message was sent to an astonished friend and neighbor who lent me, volume by volume, the W in W, how do you like your novels? I like mine strong, hot with, and no mistake. No love making. No observations about society. Little dialogue, except where the characters are bullying each other. Plenty of fighting. And a villain in the cupboard, who is to suffer tortures just before Finis. I don't like your melancholy Finis. I never read the history of a consumptive heroine twice. If I might give a short hint to an impartial writer, as the Examiner used to say in old days, it would be to act, not a la mode la pays de pole, I think that was the phraseology, but always to give quarter. In the story of Philip, just come to an end, I have the permission of the author to state that he was going to drown the two villains of the piece, a certain Dr. F. and a certain Mr. T.H. on board the President, or some other tragic ship, but you see I relented. I pictured to myself Furman's ghastly face amid the crowd of shuddering people on that reeling deck in the lonely ocean, and thought, thou ghastly lying wretch, thou shalt not be drowned. Thou shalt have a fever only, a knowledge of thy danger, and a chance ever so small a chance of repentance. I wonder whether he did repent when he found himself in the yellow fever, in Virginia? The probability is, he fancied that his son had injured him very much, and forgave him on his deathbed. Do you imagine there is a great deal of genuine right-down remorse in the world? Don't people rather find excuses which make their minds easy? Endeavor to prove to themselves that they have been lamentably belied and misunderstood, and try and forgive the persecutors who will present that bill when it is due, and not bear malice against the cruel ruffian who takes them to the police office for stealing the spoons? Years ago I had a quarrel with a certain well-known person. I believed a statement regarding him which his friends imparted to me, and which turned out to be quite incorrect. To his dying day, that quarrel was never quite made up. I said to his brother, "Why is your brother's soul still dark against me? It is I who ought to be angry and unforgiving. For I was in the wrong. In the region which they now inhabit, for Finis has been set to the volumes of the lives of both here below, if they take any cognizance of our squabbles, and tittle-tattles, and gossips on earth here, I hope they admit that my little error was not of a nature unpardonable. If you have never committed a worse, my good sir, surely the score against you will not be heavy. Ha, delictissimi my fratters! It is in regard of sins not found out, that we may say or sing in an undertone, in the most penitent and lugubrious minor key, miserior nobis miseris peccatoribus. Among the sins of commission which novel writers not seldom perpetrate, is the sin of grandiloquence, or tall talking, against which, for my part, I will offer up a special libirami. This is the sin of schoolmasters, governesses, critics, sermoners, and instructors of younger old people. Nay, for I am making a clean breast, and liberating my soul, perhaps of all the novel spinners now extant, the present speaker is the most addicted to preaching. Does he not stop perpetually in his story, and begin to preach to you? When he ought to be engaged with business, is he not forever taking the muse by the sleeve, and plaguing her with some of his cynical sermons? I cry peccavi loudly and heartily. I tell you I would like to be able to write a story which should show no egotism, whatever, in which there should be no reflections, no cynicism, no vulgarity, and so forth, but an incident in every other page, a villain, a battle, a mystery in every chapter. I should like to be able to feed a reader so spicily, as to leave him hungering and thirsting for more at the end of every monthly meal. Alexander Dumas describes himself, when inventing the plan of a work, as lying silent on his back for 2 whole days on the deck of a yacht in a Mediterranean port. At the end of the 2 days he arose and called for dinner. In those 2 days he had built his plot. He had molded a mighty clay, to be cast presently in perennial brass. The chapters, the characters, the incidents, the combinations were all arranged in the artist's brain ere he set a pen to paper. My Pegasus won't fly, so as to let me survey the field below me. He has no wings, he is blind of one eye certainly, he is restive, stubborn, slow, crops a hedge when he ought to be galloping, or gallops when he ought to be quiet. He never will show off when I want him. Sometimes he goes at a pace which surprises me. Sometimes, when I most wish him to make the running, the brute turns restive, and I am obliged to let him take his own time. I wonder, do other novel writers experience this fatalism? They must go a certain way, in spite of themselves. I have been surprised at the observations made by some of my characters. It seems as if an occult power was moving the pen. The personage does or says something, and I ask, how the dickens did he come to think of that? Every man has remarked in dreams the vast dramatic power which is sometimes evinced. I won't say the surprising power, for nothing does surprise you in dreams. But those strange characters you meet make instant observations, of which you never can have thought previously. In like manner, the imagination foretells things. We spake anon of the inflated style of some writers. What also if there is an afflated style, when a writer is like a pythoness on her oracle tripod, and mighty words, words which he cannot help, come blowing, and bellowing, and whistling, and moaning through the speaking pipes of his bodily organ. I have told you it was a very queer shock to me the other day when, with a letter of introduction in his hand, the artist's, not my, Philip Furman walked into this room, and sat down in the chair opposite. In the novel of Pendennis, written 10 years ago, there is an account of a certain Costigan, whom I had invented, as I suppose authors invent their personages out of scraps, heel taps, odds and ends of characters. I was smoking in a tavern parlor one night, and this Costigan came into the room alive, the very man. The most remarkable resemblance of the printed sketches of the man, of the rude drawings in which I had depicted him. He had the same little coat, the same battered hat, cocked on one eye, the same twinkle in that eye. Said I, knowing him to be an old friend whom I had met in unknown regions. Sir, I said, comma, may I offer you a glass of brandy and water? Added, ye may, says he, and I'll sing ye a song too. Of course he spoke with an Irish brogue. Of course he had been in the army. In 10 minutes he pulled out an army agent's account, whereon his name was written. A few months after we read of him in a police court. How had I come to know him, to divine him? Nothing shall convince me that I have not seen that man in the world of spirits. In the world of spirits and water I know I did. But that is a mere quibble of words. I was not surprised when he spoke in an Irish brogue. I had had cognizance of him before somehow. Who has not felt that little shock which arises when a person, a place, some words in a book, there is always a collocation, present themselves to you, and you know that you have before met the same person, words, scene, and so forth. They used to call the good Sir Walter the Izard of the North. What if some writer should appear who can write so enchantingly that he shall be able to call into actual life the people whom he invents? What if Mignon, and Margaret, and Geats von Berlichingen are alive now, though I don't say they are visible, and Dougal Dalgety and Ivanhoe were to step in at that open window by the little garden yonder? Suppose Uncas and our noble old leather stocking were to glide silent in? Suppose Athos, Porthos, and Aramis should enter with a noiseless swagger, curling their mustaches? And dearest Amelia Booth, on Uncle Toby's arm, and Titlibbit Titmouse, with his hair dyed green, and all the Crummles company of comedians, with the Gilblas troupe, and Sir Roger de Coverley, and the greatest of all crazy gentlemen, the Knight of La Mancha, with his blessed squire? I say to you, I look rather wistfully towards the window, musing upon these people. Were any of them to enter, I think I should not be very much frightened. Dear old friends, what pleasant hours I have had with them. We do not see each other very often, but when we do, we are ever happy to meet. I had a capital half hour with Jacob Faithful last night, when the last sheet was corrected, when Innes had been written, and the printer's boy, with the copy, was safe in Green Arbor Court. So you are gone, little printer's boy, with the last scratches and corrections on the proof, and a fine flourish by way of finish at the story's end. The last corrections? I say those last corrections seem never to be finished. A plague upon the weeds. Every day, when I walk in my own little literary garden plot, I spy some, and should like to have a spud, and root them out. Those idle words, neighbor, are past remedy. That turning back to the old pages produces anything but elation of mind. Would you not pay a pretty fine to be able to cancel some of them? Oh, the sad old pages, the dull old pages. Oh, the cares, the ennui, the squabbles, the repetitions, the old conversations over and over again. But now and again a kind thought is recalled, and now and again a dear memory. Yet a few chapters more, and then the last. After which, behold, Finis itself come to an end, and the infinite begun. On the peal of bells. As some bells in a church hard by are making a great holiday clanging in the summer afternoon, I am reminded somehow of a July day, a garden, and a great clanging of bells years and years ago, on the very day when George IV was crowned. I remember a little boy lying in that garden reading his first novel. It was called The Scottish Chiefs. The little boy, who is now ancient, and not little, read this book in the summer house of his great-grandmama. She was 80 years of age then. A most lovely and picturesque old lady, with a long tortoise-shell cane, with a little puff, or tour, of snow white, or was it powdered? hair under her cap, with the prettiest little black velvet slippers and high heels you ever saw. She had a grandson, a lieutenant in the Navy, son of her son, a captain in the Navy, grandson of her husband, a captain in the Navy. She lived for scores and scores of years in a dear little old Hampshire town inhabited by the wives, widows, daughters of Navy captains, admirals, lieutenants. Dear me! Don't I remember Mrs. Duval, widow of Admiral Duval, and the Miss Dennetts, at the great house at the other end of the town, Admiral Dennett's daughters, and the Miss Berrys, the late Captain Berry's daughters, and the good old Miss Maskews, Admiral Maskew's daughter, and that dear little Miss Norville, and the kind Miss Bookers, one of whom married Captain, now Admiral Sir Henry Excellent, K.C.C. B. Far, far away into the past I look and see the little town with its friendly glimmer. That town was so like a novel of Miss Austen's, that I wonder, was she born and bred there? No, we should have known, and the good old ladies would have pronounced her to be a little idle thing, occupied with her silly books and neglecting her housekeeping. There were other towns in England, no doubt, where dwelt the widows and wives of other Navy captains, where they tattled, loved each other, and quarreled, talked about Betty the maid, and her fine ribbons indeed, took their dish of tea at 6, played at quadrille every night till 10, when there was a little bit of supper, after which, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.